happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow.
And that was Judy Garland with Somewhere Over the Rainbow. From, what was that from? From like a movie, right? From the original movie, Phil.
Yeah,
soundtrack, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That was Ear Buddy's last song for the morning. How come I can't? There we go. Okay. And so that was nice. That was really good. And we were talking off air about Izzy. I'm having trouble remembering his full name.
Hawaiian, brilliant Hawaiian,
yeah, he's passed away, but he did a wonderful version of some of the of that song and one other song from the Wizard of Oz. So hey, you're now listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working class democratic socialist perspective, and we're here every other week, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Sundays, live on the air at WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. We're a little slice of that community base, and we are, you know, you can listen anytime by going to WMFO.org, click on schedules, click on the show. You can listen if you're outside the signal range. You can listen by going to WMFO.org. And if you are happen to be in Somerville, Medford, parts of Greater Boston, depending on the weather, the wind, and so on, you might hear us over the airwaves. I'll be your host today. My name's Jeff, and we are going to talk about lots of stuff. But one of the things that we are going to go into a little more detail on, we mentioned this in a previous show, some Gallup polling about attitudes towards socialism in the United States, especially among youth, 18 to 29, that's making some people in our society are very nervous, and you can probably figure out why. Attitudes towards capitalism and socialism played off against each other in this recent Gallup poll, and we're going to go into some detail on that. We also have Shama Sawant, K-S-H-A-M-A-S-A-W-A-N-T, Shama Sawant, a sitting Seattle city councilor, an independent socialist, a member of Socialist Alternative, has been elected twice to city council, and she's most well known for being the first socialist elected to city council in Seattle in a very long time. That's happened back in 2014. And right away, stemming from her campaign and the movement out there for 15 now, that Socialist Alternative helped get going, $15 an hour minimum wage law was passed in Seattle, the first in any major city. Now, of course, there have been many others, which is great. I have to say, realistically, though, when those laws when the Democratic Party legislature gets their hands on them, or the Republicans won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, but when the Democratic Party legislature gets a hold of the $15 legislation, they feel the need to water it down to not upset their paymasters too much. So, unfortunately, the Seattle law is still winding its way through, although it's already helped literally tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of workers in Seattle get higher wages, many up to 15 already. But there were some phase-ins, quote-unquote. I hate that term so much now, because I was out in Seattle, you know, helping. I went to the founding conference of 15 Now. I helped a little bit with this. Went out to help Shama get reelected as well. And 15 is very, very popular, as you can imagine, $15 minimum wage. In fact, it's now it's not enough. I mean, it was never. We never said it was a living wage. We were very careful not to say that because it isn't, as you know, especially in a city like Seattle or city like Boston. But on the other hand, 15 was a step forward, a good step forward. It still is, but let's be honest, we need to go beyond that now. We were talking about easily a $20 minimum wage should be coming up fast, I hope. Anyway, Shama Sawant is running for re-election again. She got re-elected with a much wider margin than her first election in 2014. I can give you some eyewitness accounts of working on her re-election campaign back in Seattle. walking up and down the hills of Seattle. That was, I'm getting a little old for that. And if you know what it's like to go door to door campaigning for somebody, you know you got to go when people are at home, right? So that's the evenings. You know, it's getting dark out. It's getting to be in the, you know, elections tend to be in November and getting, you know, anyway, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, but it was worth every minute of it. And we'll get into why Shama's running again. Shama Sawant, if you want to look that up, S-A-W-A-N-T. The first time Shama got elected, it was such a splash in a way, such a new thing that people, because this is before the Sanders campaign, this is before, you know, Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist, etc. He's not, I'm afraid to say, but we can get into that later. And the word democratic socialist has really kind of been thrown around a lot. Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, has many, tens of thousands of members on paper now. So it's definitely in circulation, you know, more. And we're going to go into that polling data, like I mentioned, from Gallup, attitudes towards socialism now. But basically we have, a lot of things called democratic socialism are basically just reformism, basically just liberal ideas that because the United States is so overall without, so conservative without a, not the people, but the political duopoly of the Democrats and Republicans is quite unusual around the world. And a lot of people don't understand that. Don't blame them. We don't, you know, I grew up in a typical American public school education, knew nothing about, you know, Canada, right north of the, you know, I grew up in upstate New York. Hey, there's Canada. I knew nothing about Canada. Healthcare system in Canada, you know, new Democratic Party in Canada. Knew nothing about Mexico, you know. Anyway, not blaming people, but the fact is that most countries have, especially industrialized countries, you know, but also even poorer countries have political parties that are not controlled by the corporations in that country or corporations internationally. They're political parties not controlled by big business. And Democratic Party, Republican Party is completely controlled by big business, completely corporate political parties. And so in other countries, you actually have much more, many more choices to vote for. In Mexico, for example, recently, a new party was created around the candidacy and other campaigns of other candidates that was completely to the left of what the corporations wanted, and they didn't, and was not funded by the corporations. So, political party not using corporate money, that's anti-capitalist, that's pro-worker. You know, what are known as labor parties or socialist parties or communist parties in some countries. These exist in multitudes around the world. They exist in many countries. You can actually vote for a party that's not controlled by big business. It gets tricky, of course, because once a party gains power like that, big business will do everything it can to influence them, to start giving them corporate money if they'll accept it, to give them positions of power, to corrupt them, basically. And so many parties that started out as socialist, as revolutionary, namely, a good example would be social democratic parties in Europe. They, over the course of the 20th century and into the 21st century now, they lost their revolutionary goals. They lost their goals of socialism. Some of them now, for example, like, I don't know, there's unfortunately many examples. The French Socialist Party, completely pro-capitalist, will enact worse austerity measures than openly capitalist parties. The British Labour Party went through a period under Blair and so on where it was basically, it had destroyed its roots. It had removed from its constitution a clause called Clause 4 about public ownership of big business, of corporations, and so on. Now it's a little different with Corbyn there, and a big mistake the British leaders of the British Labour Party made when they allowed a new wave of membership to come in. That's changed back to a party that has potential, not realization yet, but potential of becoming a real party for working people again. I'm not sure what they're accepting for funding these days. But unfortunately, they still have people like Blair inside. Although some people just split. Some right-wing politicians just split from the British Labour Party, which is quite good because they need to go as fast as possible. They're trying to keep the British Labour Party a tool of of the capitalists, of big business, like it unfortunately devolved into. But anyway, I don't want to get too far into that. I'm just saying that, you know, here our political choices are extremely narrow, down to two parties, and the corporate media doing everything it can to splice that and dice that and make it seem like there are real choices out there, and there really aren't. And it's reflected in policies that, like right now, are being put out by some people in the Democratic Party, Sanders, AOC, et cetera, Ocasio-Cortez, et cetera, as radical policies. And the media will just repeat, these are radical policies. These are radical policies. They're not radical policies. They're things that have been achieved in other countries decades ago. And at least, if not before that, like national health care. And so this, so someone can label themselves a democratic socialist or something by saying they're for like Medicare for all, which we're also going to talk about today a little bit, if we have time. And Medicare for all, which, you know, you have to read the fine print, but basically you're talking about some sort of national health care, from what I've seen, like looking at what Sanders is proposing and so on. This is, like I said, this is basic in other countries. And here it's considered radical by the corporate media. I don't think most people consider it radical, although there are moments when the corporate media really pours it on. I was listening to National Propaganda Radio the other day, a very conservative radio station. I know that people will be, what do you mean? National Public Radio is so, so beautiful, so wonderful. I couldn't live without it. I donate every other day, and I love Scott Simon and you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't know. I've been listening to National Propaganda Radio, unfortunately, a lot. I listen to a lot of radio, unfortunately. And basically, NPR is cheerleading the coup attempt and the sanctions on Venezuela right now. And yeah, this show is called Socialist Alternative Radio. We're socialists. We're upfront about that. Maduro's not a socialist. Venezuela's not socialist. Even under Chavez, Venezuela wasn't socialist. Chavez was a left reformer, a left populist. In the real sense of the word, he was moving towards socialism, maybe, maybe not. It was debatable. But he enacted reforms. He took the oil money in Venezuela that had already been nationalized, by the way, before Chavez. But what he did was he fired all the corrupt people running it that were running it like a business and siphoning the money into the rich, into the other business and into the rich of Venezuela. And he'll never be forgiven for that. Never. As long as capitalism exists. You don't have to be a socialist to get the wrath of capitalism to fall on your head. Very, very sharply. I was reading a article from Black Agenda Report, which I highly recommend them, both their podcasts and their print material. Black Agenda Report was saying, yeah, you know, I'm paraphrasing, they were saying, yeah, you don't have to be a real socialist to get capitalists really angry at you. A few key demands in a situation that they want to be completely controlled, completely conservative, in the true sense of the word. That is enough, you know. Like Sanders is, you know, he's trash talked Chavez, called Chavez a dead communist dictator. He's making noises against U.S. Imperialist intervention, but then on the other hand, attacking Maduro. He's not going to do anything if they do. You know, he's not doing anything against the sanctions and so on. I don't know what he would do if there's a full scale. You know, coup, he probably would not say much about that. He would probably protest against it. If there was some sort of U.S. invasion, I think Sanders would have to oppose that in some way. But even then, I wouldn't see Sanders out making that like a, you know, trying to organize a mass movement against that. Other people would be doing that, and Sanders would have to choose whether or not to support that, and I wouldn't hold my breath. But anyways, getting back to the main point here of the limited, very limited democracy that we have, and what can, you know, what's on, you know, what's out there that's being labeled democratic socialist now is extremely problematic. And is it worth, like, you know, parsing and getting into the details of that? Sometimes I would say no. Sometimes it's not. You know, if there really was if there really was like hardcore socialists out there besides Sham or Sawant, you know, in you know, being elected, I would say yeah. You know, there's points of time where we don't have to hash out disagreements, and we need unity and so on. But if you're going to choose the Democratic Party as your vehicle, and you're going to direct people to the Democratic Party, and you're going to organize people into the Democratic Party, then That's like a major difference between that and real socialism. You know, if you want to, real socialism has to have some baseline, right? It's got to be like, one, you're anti-capitalist, okay? And two, you don't support capitalist political parties. You're for what's, you know, shorthand political independence of the working class. And in the United States, we don't have that baseline going as far as popular discourse goes. We have, or as far as the corporate media goes, it's very, very good for the capitalists to say, well, no, no, this is also, this what you call socialism is also part of capitalism. You know, like, for example, Ocasio-Cortez said on TV a couple of weeks ago, yes, you can be a capitalist and a democratic socialist. Well, no, you can't, you know. And you just can't. It's two antithetical things. Socialism is a different economic system than capitalism. It's an economic system where the big corporations, the big parts of the economy, not every last little small business, but the big parts of the economy are publicly owned and controlled. And you bring democracy to the places, the important places, the most important places in society where things are made, things are produced, things are how they're going to be, decisions made about how to produce them for, you know, sustainability, environmental sustainability, and public health, and so on. And how are they going to be distributed? For only, are they only going to be sold for profit, or can they be actually distributed based on human need? That's the basics of socialism, right there. And you know, that's why they call it, you know, democratic socialism, because you will be making, well, that's why it used to be called that. You'll be making many more democratic decisions. Democracy deepened by a huge amount in a society where the real power, economic power, is no longer in the hands of a few. And it would have to be international as well. It can't just be in one country, obviously. That's a sort of lesson from the socialist movement internationally since it got started in the 1800s. So it's very, very important that there be sort of this common understanding. But, of course, you know, corporations don't want people to have a common understanding of what socialism is. And so a lot of things get thrown into this democratic socialist ideal that's got nothing to do with socialism, you know. And you know, there's people that would say that's fine, that's okay. I just want, you know, some generalized improvement towards the kind of left in general, you know. Things just get a little better. Well, I could understand that if things stood still for you. If things stood still, then if progressives made gains, say in a country like Canada or Britain, where you have a national healthcare system, if you could be guaranteed under capitalism that once that national healthcare system is won politically, then the capitalists won't touch it. Then everything's fine. We don't need to struggle for, you know, fundamental economic change, which is socialism. We can just say, all right, that, you know, we've achieved enough that, you know, enough people are doing okay. And that's good enough for me. That's what liberals argue all the time. And I find, well, first of all, I find that argument incredibly arrogant, because there's obviously enough wealth around. And, you know, Marx talks about this in, Karl Marx talks about this in everything from the Communist Manifesto to Capital. There's enough wealth generated under capitalism that if it could be controlled by the people that create the wealth, working people, then everyone could have a decent life. So to judge, to say, that 20%, that's consistently suffering, but 80% are not. And by the way, that's not the case now. We have 80% living paycheck to paycheck in America. And that's not, I didn't just make that up. That's an established fact in a lot of sociological studies now. So I'm not, you know, but, you know, to say that 20% suffering for all time under capitalism is the price that we must pay to keep capitalism going, to keep a few people getting richer and richer and richer, that's the height of arrogance to me. That's just disgusting. That's inhuman. That's just inhumane, inhuman, whatever the word is I'm looking for. But on the other hand, the main counter argument is that your reforms are not guaranteed under capitalism. They don't stay there. There's an idea that you know, things are constantly improving under capitalism in terms of social well-being, as if nothing ever goes backward. So right now, when most people don't have pensions anymore, that's just not really taken into account. When people are threatened with bankruptcy over nursing home costs, which they didn't used to be when that was more regulated, that's not taken into account. When people are going into deep, deep debt for college and others not being able to consider college because of the cost of it. And that's new. That's a new problem. That's not taken into account, right? When healthcare, even with health insurance, and you can see Michael Moore's Sicko from the 90s or whatever that film came out for what I'm talking about here, even with health insurance, you end up, when you have to use it, it doesn't work the way you're told it was going to, and you're going to go bankrupt because most bankruptcies in the U.S. are tied to healthcare costs, even with people with insurance. Then all these things are going backwards. It's not like there's a forward march of capitalism in terms of social well-being. There are times where people get poorer. The Great Recession was a setback for hundreds of millions of people, tens of millions of people, let's say. No, I want to exaggerate. Tens of millions of people in the United States, severe setback in their living standards, right? So it's not a question of, oh, yeah, maybe, you know, oh, we got rid of child labor, right? You didn't get rid of child labor, you know, basically radicals got rid of child labor, socialists and so on. But anyway, so no more child labor, right, in the United States. Is that even guaranteed? I mean, I've seen examples where it's not. Under the table, exploitation of immigrants and so on. I've seen things, I mean, I'm getting older, I've seen things that show me, even in my own lifetime, things can go backwards. So that's one of the arguments that socialists have for fundamental transformation of the system. That's what they have. We either go forward and create a system based on where human needs are the primary reason for working and producing things, or it's for the profit of a few. Sorry for the coughing. I had a flu shot, but still got sick. So a lot of what is happening now is basic reformism is being labeled radicalism a lot here in the United States, which is a bit behind many other countries in the world right now. Basic political choices are narrowed down to two corporate political parties. Excuse me, where in other countries you have a range of choices. And that doesn't mean that they other countries escape all the traps that we face here in the United States of lesser evilism and so on. Other countries have a parliamentary system, which is allows more representation of different ideas and so on. But there are some times where, through alliances and so on, people are forced to vote lesser evilism. And the corporations still are exerting huge influences over the political system and controlling the political system in capitalist countries. It's quite, you can pass whatever law you want. Campaign finance laws are not the be-all and end-all of anything. They don't work under capitalism. I'm not saying that I would never support them, or socialists or progressives or whoever shouldn't support them. I'm just saying that you're not making much of a dent in the problem when that's what happens. Because take, for example, the recent laws in the United States against PAC money. They have found a way to create these things called super PACs that, as long as they can't prove, the government, if it's so moved to even look, can't prove collusion between the campaign of a candidate X and the super PAC, then the super PAC can spend as much money as it wants promoting the candidate. And if you don't think there's collusion happening anyway, you're crazy. So basically, it's just a way of getting around, you know, the laws that are made. The Democrats in the midterm elections in November, they were saying this. They put this at the top of their list of things they want to do to avoid the stuff that most people really want them to do. And one of them was campaign finance, get money out of politics, that's like saying, I'm not even going to look for the right metaphor. That's just forget about it. The Democratic Party's bought and paid for. And they are not interested in getting money out of politics at all. It's just they're just pandering. They're just doing, the left populist thing they're doing right now. And basically, some of them are doing. And they are talking about that while basically money's flooding in more than ever before, and from big donors, go. There's this really good website that basically is can show you the facts and figures, and I've talked about it before and read some of the facts and figures out over the air, called opensecrets.org. And what's so good about that website is they trend things. They don't just say, well, this year X happened. They say, no, look at over the this year compared to another year, blah, blah, blah. It's getting worse. Corporate money, the influence of the super rich. And influence is such a weaselly word. I don't mean to use that. I mean the control of the super rich over the political system in this country is getting even more, and you're unsure how that be possible, but even more entrenched, even more obvious, even more resources going into that. Actually, you know, we're going to take a quick musical interlude. Usually we do that a little bit later, but you are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. We might have to change that democratic socialist thing because it's getting so abused lately. Like, for example, Sanders, as an example, he talks about, he gave that news conference last year where he, or not last year, I'm sorry, 2016, where he goes, I'm going to define social, what I mean by socialism. And I followed Sanders from way, way back. You know, I've met the guy, you know, he's, he was mayor of Burlington. I was following him back then, checking, you know, excited by some of the things he did, et cetera. So, know people that know him, all that kind of stuff, right? So, I won't go through a history of Sanders' move to the right, but there's been a consistent move to a more conservative position to the point where he defined, he used to talk about Eugene Debs, and that's a legitimate role model if you want to be a socialist. Eugene Debs is the real deal. Eugene Debs of the Socialist Party of the United States. Look him up if you know, haven't heard of him, D-E-B-S, Eugene Debs, real socialist, a hero, actually, to working people. Well, ran for president from prison when Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, threw him in prison for speaking out against the draft during World War I. There were laws set up during World War I that made it a crime to speak against the war, to speak against the draft. So much for free speech when the interests of capital are really challenged. And so Sanders used to say Debs was his hero, and he still, I think, would say that to some people. Cool. That's great. But then when Sanders had that opportunity to define what he thought was socialism was, he did not talk about Debs. He talked about Roosevelt. He talked about Johnson. He talked about, I think it was Kennedy was the other one. And when asked about a foreign example of a socialist, he said, Winston Churchill. Now, he's not a socialist, but I really admire the way he, you know, united the British people. So, wow, okay, wait a minute. Churchill was a war criminal, an arch-capitalist, arch-conservative, responsible for a famine in India that killed millions of people. I mean, Churchill responsible for things that we're still suffering from in the way the Middle East was divided up in the post-war period. I mean, Churchill is the enemy of anyone that considers himself a socialist. But let's look at the more benign examples. Roosevelt used to say to people openly, say, you know, right-wingers that got pissed off at some of the reforms that he put forward to save capitalism, as he put it, I'm saving capitalism for you. Why are you angry at me? And that kind of sums it up. Roosevelt came from old money, came from the old Democratic Party, deal for about a century with, almost a century, with Jim Crow in the South. Run by Democrats, controlled by Democrats. So racist to the core. Interned Japanese Americans, et cetera, called out troops on strikers more than any other president. Roosevelt. You can knock down that kind of progressive veneer on Roosevelt. You can wipe off that progressive veneer pretty easily if you're truthful, if you believe in actual scholarship and actual objectivity. You can show the truth about Roosevelt. No socialist, not a socialist. You know, a very popular capitalist who at times, not always, did a left populist thing. There's a book called Labor's Giant Step by Art Pries, P-R-E-I-S or P-R-I-E-S. And Pries was an activist and became a socialist during the Depression. And he wrote, and this book is really a brilliant book about the rise of the CIO, but the first like 100 pages are about what it was like prior to the rise of the CIO. CIO is the Congress Industrial Organizations. union federations in the United States that split from the AFL and then eventually reemerged in 1953, unfortunately, with the AFL. And the CIO for a while was very left-wing and had a lot of Communist Party influence and so on in the United States. So priests who lived through that period would say, well, let's look at Roosevelt, what he really did. You know, they would do the, before an election, they would increase the funding on public works programs, then after the election, cut back on them. They had a different wage, a lower wage in the South than they did in the North. They would do a thing with the public works programs where it got to the point where the workers would say, well, this is, the wages were not enough to live on, but just too much to die on. That was the phrase. They couldn't get ahead. Now, for some workers, the just to get any kind of wage in the depths of the Depression was a lifesaver, and they hung on without, if they didn't see an alternative, to just voting for Roosevelt. But other workers who had to go into struggle, had to do planned occupations or the famous sit-down strikes, they were battling the Roosevelt administration. And there was a big push in the 30s for a labor party of some sort of alternative to every year the Democrats coming back to power. And the Communist Party, unfortunately, did a very horrible maneuver then, where it would suck up a lot of that energy in a radical-sounding way or radical look that it had, and then channel it back into the Democratic Party. They actually supported the Democrats over and over again. That's been a feature of the American left ever since the Socialist Party of Debs to support, much of the American left to support the Democratic Party. So Roosevelt and then later at any given election, you'll find a section of the left supporting the Democratic Party, and whether they define that as the Democratic Party progressives or whatever. But what is really unfortunate, obviously, is that even when there are mass movements that are trying to break out of that corporate duopoly, you know, whether it's the mass movements of the Depression going into the 40s, even the late 40s, whether it's the civil rights movement, whether it was the civil rights movement going into the anti-war movement and the Black Power movement, a lot of attempts to move beyond the Democratic Party, but unfortunately also a lot of attempts to reform the Democratic Party, stay within the Democratic Party. And even into the 80s, Jesse Jackson runs a lot of the Maoist groups, for example, small Maoist groups that had been popular in the 60s and 70s, rather inexplicably, but whatever. They get behind Jackson, another Democratic Party candidate. So it's this thing over and over again. Now Sanders is doing the same shtick, running as a Democrat, pulling sections of the left into supporting him while he strengthens the Democratic Party with his runs. Now, does he is he putting forward some good issues? Absolutely. But as he himself has said in the past, and it's kind of funny, it's hypocritical, basically, but he says, look, you don't win these things without mass movements. But what he doesn't tie together is that if you're channeling all the energy in the Democratic Party and into the legislation and lobbying and litigation and all that stuff at the top of the stratosphere where the big money boys are, you know, then that is where that energy goes. It doesn't go in the streets. You don't find Democratic Party figures, including Sanders, you don't find them out organizing mass movements. They've thrown their lot into, as individuals, by the way, into an institution, into a party that doesn't do that. It doesn't do that. It creates, like, look at the recent women's movements. The women's movement after Trump got elected, the women's marches, they were really good. I mean, numbers were really great. There was a lot of energy. A lot of people in Socialist Alternative were involved in that. Problem was that right from the start, the leaders of that movement tied it in, and some of them were already Democrats, NGO, bigwigs, and all that. They were tying that more and more to the Democratic Party. So when it got to this third iteration of the women's movement marches, the anti-Trump marches around women's issues, the one that happened recently, a lot of cities didn't happen in different reasons. But one of the reasons in some cities was that the leaders were so tied to the Democratic Party that they thought, given the results of the Democrats taking back the House in November 2017, I'm sorry, November 2018. That was enough that everything was done. The job was done for now. We're just going to focus on 2020. And we don't need to pull people out in January, this past January, last month, for a big marches. And that kind of really dissipated the power of the marches, even where they happened. Like, in you know, I was at the one in Boston with members of Social Alternative, and it was not only low attended, relatively speaking, but it was completely focused, again, on Democratic Party personalities. In this case, Ayanna Pressley, who... And this is a function of kind of what I was talking about, the redefinition of the rebranding of Democratic Social and the rebranding of progressive even. So Ayanna Pressley is considered progressive. You can read that in a lot of places now. But she was in the Boston City Council for 9 years prior to getting elected, you know, in that race against Capuano here in the Boston area. And wait a minute. What did she do for 9 years in the Democratic, I'm sorry, and the Boston City Council as a Democrat? She did very, very little, and was not known as a progressive. She got liquor licenses for some of her friends in JP and stuff, but she did not get, she did not fight the two waves of school closures that happened during that time. She was not on the front lines of that. She didn't, you know, if you were active in Boston progressive politics, you did not see her out, you know? So it's not a question of, rebranding and rewriting. I mean, you know, you got to earn that stuff. You got to earn the progressive label. You got to earn the Democratic Socialist label. And the earning part is not really happening. And the rewriting of that, which is really very much in favor of big business and the corporations, is happening on a constant basis now. But, you know, in the end of the day, it's events. It's where people stand on crucial events that's going to sort that out, not just arguments about it, not just discussions about it. Although I think there is a necessity and a room for, otherwise I wouldn't be bothering to go into it. There is a necessity and room for talking about it and trying to say, look, this really is socialist and that it's anti-capitalist and it's, you know, not connected to big business and corporations and the super rich. This is progressive. You know, I mean, you know, as despite what I've been saying, it's don't take from that like I wouldn't welcome, or I think a lot of members of Social Alternative, a lot of socialists in general, I think we would welcome a truly progressive party to the left of the Democrats, independent of the Democrats, independent of big business and corporate money and money from the super rich. That would be a big step forward, even if it wasn't explicitly socialist. Just as long as it was politically independent of capital, of the bourgeois, as you know, as they say in the Communist Manifesto and so on. If it was, if a party that was even working, excuse me, even working its program out and trying to figure out where to go, but had at least as a starting point, sort of as a principle, we're not going to take any money from the super rich and big business and the big corporations. We're not going to do that. And we have these basic demands we feel are good. Say it's Medicare for all or improve Medicare for all or whatever. But you know, on the question of capitalism, they're debating it. They're afraid to come out against it or whatever. That still would be a step forward. I mean, it would have to come up against the central questions of capitalism. Sort of like, for example, Venezuela. You know, we were talking about earlier. Chavez was never a socialist because he couldn't figure out, or he didn't want to push, the central question of what of whether or not to take on capitalism. Even at the height of Chavismo, or however you say it, in Venezuela, with a certain amount of nationalization happening of the economy, there was still the vast majority of the economy was in private hands, and boy, did they wreak havoc with that. They being the capitalists that controlled most of the economy. And that includes the media, by the way. There's a lot of misinformation, a huge amount of misinformation, just lies about Venezuela under Chavez, Venezuela under Maduro. In fact, Maduro started out trying to do what Chavez did. The oil revenues dried up. Instead of finding other ways to deepen the revolution, more taking things under public ownership, really going towards socialism, he tried to do a deal with, a lot of people don't know this, he tried to do a deal with both the Venezuelan capitalists and U.S. imperialism, and took away, started to tear down a lot of the gains made under Chavez. Like, for example, under healthcare. They didn't have a public, you know, a national healthcare system, but they had subsidized healthcare in many poor areas with Cuban doctors and so on helping out at times. And Maduro basically reprivatized, if you want to put it simply, sectors of the healthcare economy that had started to become more public, more socialistic in a way, even. Again, not a socialist system, but, you know, heavy subsidies for healthcare. Poor people being able to go to college for the first time in a very unequal class stratified society, Venezuela and the United States, by the way. But anyway, and Maduro tried to, you know, they had subsidized grocery stores, subsidized places to food, like I don't want to call them, you know, cafeterias or something. I don't know what to call them, places you could get food, get a meal. This wasn't brought in uniformly across the entire country, but it was happening. And Maduro didn't want to keep that up. He felt like he could get rid of some of those reforms, a lot of those reforms, and that would show his, that would get capitalism to back off, basically, both in Venezuela and from the United States and so on. But it doesn't. It just showed weakness. It just showed the capitalists that, why stop there? Why not go try to reprivatize the oil regime there? You know, the oil ownership of the Venezuelan oil production, which, by the way, Venezuela shows itself to have has been researched, it's been studied. It has the largest proven reserves of oil in the entire world by a long shot when compared by country. So you're wondering why U.S. imperialism is once again rattling its swords, its weaponry there. Why the CIA is up to its, is probably, you know, already has its hands bloodied terribly is doing crimes down in Venezuela. Why there's a lot of sanctions and other outright theft of Venezuelan assets and so on around the world, led by the United States. Why a sort of rich, greedy, really nasty person like Guaido, or however you say his name, is considered by national propaganda radio, considered, they'll say, quote, he's the legitimate ruler of Venezuela, considered so by many countries. Can you, like, just tear that sentence apart for a second? Considered so by many countries. Well, the guy didn't run in the last elections. He didn't run. He hasn't run in any elections, as far as I remember. But he hasn't run in the last elections, at least. And other people did. The idea that Maduro is an authoritarian is crazy. And I'm not defending Maduro. I just got through saying policies he did I didn't like at all. And other socialists didn't like. And a lot of the people try to defend Venezuela from U.S. imperialism. Now, they're not saying they're pro-Maduro, but they're also not leaving that choice to U.S. imperialism, to the big corporations in the United States. It's not their choice. You know, Maduro won an election, and the election was monitored. The election was considered legitimate, and there were opposition figures that lost that election, not Guaido or whatever his name is. That guy's a complete fiction. He's a complete puppet of the United States. He's already met Trump secretly, got the nod. Can you imagine being in a meeting with Trump? He says, okay, yeah, you're our boy in Venezuela now. I mean, it's the kind of ridiculously corrupt person you have to be, kind of evil little piece of garbage you have to be to go through that process and then go back. And if this guy gains power, there's going to be a river of blood in Venezuela. Because the poor people, they still remember Chavez. They still remember the masses of Venezuela. They still remember the improvements, and they know that those improvements have disintegrated or been walked away from. They've been dismantled to a certain extent. But what existed before that, wave after wave of dictatorship in Venezuela, incredible inequality. They're not interested in that. They don't want that to come back. And the people that the United States puts up, like this Guaido guy, they don't even know who he is. You know, He just is a ridiculous figure that is threatening there, basically, and they don't want that. So anyway, we're gonna come back with those figures that we talked about last time about the Gallup survey views about capitalism and socialism by age after we play some music. You'll like this song. It's about Venezuela in a way.
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns jammed downtown. The killing clowns, the blood money men. The shooting goes. Washington bullets again. As every cell in Chile will tell the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende in the days before the army came. Remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Es verdad. Those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy and the Cuban Sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color.
Desire upon these eroded shores, carrying the goods pieces of history, but a history it's unwritten. The oil burns in thick black columns, the buzzsaws echo through the forest floor. They shout, give us our fair share, give us justice. South of here, two young men in makeshift uniforms peer into the misty light. And figures dart behind the trees as a snap of rifle rounds echoes out across the fields. Well, they hardly know their secret mother tongue. Yeah, but they recognize the duty to defend the flag hanging limp and bloody above the village church. Thousand miles away, in a warehouse complex down by the river. Tell us one of those great stories, the ones about serial killers.
Your dreams flow into savage toy.
Cheer the sirens screaming out across the city. We had three odd nights in succession. The riot season is here again.
Dear Lord, lead us back to the valley of the shadow.
Born in peaceful times. The whirling derby spinning around faster, faster. The center cannot hold. Like a whirling derby spinning, spinning faster. Ah, oh, the center cannot hold. On the Age of Reason!
New Model Army. Here Comes the War from New Model Army Original 20. When did that come out? A while ago. New Model Army is an old punk band that's kept producing music, playing around. Don't get to the U.S. too much. I saw them so long ago. This came out in... I'm not finding it. Oh, well. We'll say early 2000s, but maybe even before that. So, and before that was The Clash with Washington Bullets from their album Sandinista from 1980. And speaking of a theme we had earlier in the show of reforms are not guaranteed under capitalism. There's not the sort of slow progression towards some sort of socialism or mix of capitalism and socialism. That's impossible. Capitalism always, always must dominate, must continue to profit monger, find new sources of cheap labor, cheap natural resources to exploit, cheap labor to exploit, and places to make profit, to privatize if necessary, to create profit-making opportunities from things that were considered essential services and therefore not open to the exploitation and waste and just horror of the markets, really. You'll notice the title of that Clash album, Sandinista, because there was a revolution in 1979, a guerrilla revolution in Nicaragua, a small Central American country. At the time, it was a big deal because it was the age of Reagan was coming into power and vowed he would destroy them. Reagan and the capitalists did wear them down. The Sandinistas made mistakes. They weren't really socialist. They were more nationalistic, but they used... They had a lot of reforms in mind, but they, when they got into power, they only took under public ownership about 40% of the economy. So again, they left the real economic power translates into political power, basically. And so they left a lot of political power, economic power, and therefore political power in the hands of the capitalists in Nicaragua. And so basically... it was just a matter of years with the help of, U.S. imperialism, the Reagan administration, CIA and all that, Oliver North and all that stuff. If you want to go back and research it, Google Oliver North and secret drugs for weapons thing. They set nasty, corrupt thing they set up to try to undermine the government there, and they succeeded. And now fast forward to... maybe about 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I'm a little unclear on the chronology. One of the old leaders of that revolution came back but had rebranded himself a capitalist, and he, Daniel Ortega, and he ran as a neoliberal, as a pro-capitalist candidate in a pro-capitalist party. They got elected. There was the economy... got even worse, there were protests where he then used the state, Ortega used the state to try to destroy the protest movement, and you heard a little bit about that in the United States, but not that much, really. Right now, if you went around the world and found all the countries with truly authoritarian regimes, not Maduro, that's not an authoritarian regime, it's not a regime I support or anything, but it's not an authoritarian regime, then you will see a lot of places, a lot of examples that we just don't hear about in the corporate media here, anywhere from Thailand to Saudi Arabia to Indonesia, a lot of places where Brazil now with Bolsonaro, you're going to see some really horrible things happening there. But no, we're going to focus on Venezuela. It's corporate media, okay. Anyway, speaking of what we promised earlier on, there was a Gallup poll in August. The poll, I don't have the exact date of the poll. It was reported on by Gallup in August. So it was around that time of 2018. It's a poll they've been doing consistently since 2010. What I would like to know is why they started that poll in 2010. And I'm not sure. Because the poll is views about capitalism and socialism by age. And, it might have been, it was perceptive of them to do that because with the way the economy has been going, the capitalist economy at an international scale, not just in the United States, it's inevitable that socialism is going to be of more interest to people. And it's inevitable capitalism is going to suffer it's in terms of its acceptance by people, hopefully. That's pretty well guaranteed, if you see your living standards go down. But in any case, let's get to the point here, because I fill in the blanks from last time we talked about this. So, what's reported on here is 2010, 2012, 2016, 2018, those years. Now, views about capitalism and socialism by age, 18 to 29-year-olds. Now, this is the one that caught their eye, got some press in the corporate media, not much, but a little bit. So a positive view of capitalism by 18 to 29-year-olds in 2018 was only 45%, less than a majority, whereas 51% had a positive view of socialism. 51% of 18 to 29-year-olds in 2018, 51% had a positive view of socialism. Now, based on what we've already been talking about in the show, that I am worried, I would say, what that idea is, what the definition of socialism is in the mind of the people responding to this poll. That is an important question to try to figure out. And I will assume that not everybody understands